Thank you. So in trying to think what I could talk about for this frontier, I thought I would remind us how much we've covered in the last 25 years, so in broad brushes, and then make a couple of points along the way, like how Planck helped Neil not to lose yet his bet with Stephen, as one. Then I'll also tell you things which are more like a couple of weeks old results, so sort of really bring you to where we are today. And then the last part of my talk, if I have time, would be to sort of convince you that in some respect, we are in the same state today than we were at Discovery Day in COBE, at COBE days, but at least now for polarization. So let me remind you that Planck originated, too bad, the joke for Neil, he was not there to hear it, but that's okay. So Planck came from a sort of a dream when the COBE results came out back in 92. And it was clear that we knew sort of the order of magnitude of what was a signal, at least on large scales. So you could sort of dream with, just based on general physics argument, what is essentially the damping scale or silk damping scale, what is this, all the scales that you want to cover. So it was easy to sort of say as a theorist, which was at the time, which was pretty much what I was, just to say, well, if we want to extract all of the information, that's very simple. You do all the sphere, all the way to 5 minutes of arc, with a sensitivity that allows to have high signal to noise for an RMS, which will be of the order of 50 micro K, maybe if it's strings, and maybe 100 micro K if it's inflation. Of course, at the time, we didn't know that. And then, of course, so it says you'd like to have micro K type sensitivity on all those scales. And then, of course, we knew that there were foregrounds, and so you wanted to have a very broad coverage. So we worked for 3 years to try to make a coherent proposal, and thanks to a lot of people in the physics community that joined us, even though we were outsiders, we did get the big ticket of building a medium-sized mission at ESA. That was decided in 96. And then there were a few years of agony, 16 typically, to actually turn this dream into this machine as it was in Kourou just before flight. So this thing is like 4 meter by 4 meter. It's about 2 tons. It's a 1.5 meter aperture primary. There are secondaries there, and it's rotating around this axis, sort of roughly in the sun anti-solar direction. And then the stuff about this thing is that we proposed to reach, I mean, the only way to reach those pretty ambitious objectives was to say, well, we'll put in a new technology in space, essentially bolometers. But of course, bolometers are essentially thermometers. And if you are trying to look at micro K sensitivity, you'd better have to cool them and in a stable fashion. And so that was a requirement of doing things at 0.1K. in the core there, so this is essentially a big cryogenic machine. Well, we did launch the thing in 2009 from French Guiana, and maybe the core of the secret of Planck is here. Here are 900 days from essentially when we started operation to when we stopped the cryogenic operations, and then there was a bit more. And if you look at, so this is the core of Planck. This is a HFI box. It's about that size. There are like 50 horns, and here are, this is where it defined the spectral band passes, and here are the bolometers. And the temperature there, it can be monitored, and what you see is this is 0.10 Kelvin. The stability is 0.1 millikelvin, and that's for 900 days. So that's pretty good observing conditions. So cutting the rest of the story short, well, what you have now is this. So these are 9 full sky maps, 9 different frequencies. For 7 of them, on the right side, you also see the polarization. Well, this is just a polarization degree. And anybody can now download this. I wish we could do this for the ground experiments someday. And then to give you some idea of with the characteristics of those maps, the sort of core central frequency at 143 gigahertz at 7.3 minutes of arc as angular resolution, and the level of noise there is such that if you look at the 1 degree pixel, you find 0.5 microkelvin of RMS noise, and matching level of residual systematics. So from there, let me focus on temperature for a second. Well, you get a lot of astrophysics because that's what you have to cope with. Synchrotron, free, spinning dust, CO lines, Saniev-Zeldovich, and so on. And this is actually led to many scientific progresses and a lot of publications and so on, and make the community happy. But I'll just focus on the temperature map that you've probably all seen, and you now see that yes, these were not strings as the primary source, but this is not Planck. The turning point was 2000 with Boomerang and Maxima. But anyway, this is about 100 microkelvin. But that's not actually how we get to the power spectrum. What we do is we actually start from the maps themselves. And here is what you see. When you look, for instance, the cross-correlation between the 100 channels, here are the basic dots, just a straight measurement. The only thing you do is you just mask the worst places of the sky, that is to say, well, the galactic plane mostly. And that's what you obtain. And you see the noise level, which is shown by this, is actually pretty low. You just one frequency, it's pretty obvious. This is 143 cross 143. You can do this in very all kinds of frequencies. And then you can also see what is our best fit solution about the foreground level once you've applied this kind of mask. And you can clearly see that these are really low levels. So it's sort of immediately you have a way to mitigate the foregrounds knowing where to look. And then the question is just then to see how far you can go in terms of maximizing the number of modes that you can use while still being able to cope with the foregrounds. Of course, there are many practical details in all of this. I mean, the mask, the which range, you don't use all the range of the same range of the data and so on. You have to model the foregrounds, if anything, to be able to forward propagate the uncertainties related to residual foregrounds. And then, of course, you do a lot of tests. And the basis for this is we build a big likelihood with a big covariance matrix. And in principle, this has about 23,000 square elements. That's a pretty big matrix. And the question is, of course, how do you make sure that this matrix is right? Because this is, after all, what will be governing your uncertainties in the end. Cutting this short, this is a Planck 2015 temperature and isotropy spectrum. You see the individual measurements, which are the gray dots. When you bin things, this is the blue dots. These are the blue dots. And of course, you know that if you just look in your theory box, well, lambda CDM was just a few parameters, fits extremely well. And this is, for instance, this red curve. And you can look at the residuals. And you can sort of see that as soon as you bin, I mean, you don't see anything even by eye at the level of a few microkelvin square. So that's where we are. And Planck, by the way, is a cosmic variance limited experiment all the way to L of 1600. And it so turns out, as we had promised, that, well, at least for minimal models like lambda CDM, this is where you saturate the diminishing of the uncertainties with the sky coverage. So essentially, you cannot do any better for lambda CDM. We've extracted all of the information. Of course, if you look at extensions, I mean, there are still some value in there, and we can improve on this. Now, given the importance of that result, so we went through a lot of consistency check, because of course, I mean, it's not enough to have high precision being off mark. What you want is actually also high accuracy. And so one of the things you can do, for instance, when you have such a large data set, is actually take differences when you have accounted for foregrounds and you have all of these different measurements and you know them. So you don't have to know the CMB because you've taken out the foreground, so you are just taking the CMB in different frequency bands, and you look at the differences for different data combination as expressed as what you expect in terms of uncertainties. And this is beautiful. This is just completely coherent. We have all of these detectors that tell us the same story. So we are pretty glad about that. Then you can do all kinds of other tests. You essentially look at the data in many different ways. You drop some channels, you vary the L range over which you do cosmology, you use different data combination. And in the end, you look at, well, how the various cosmological parameters are varying, and you compare to what the extent to which they should vary, given the amount of varying data, and it all jibes, and we are happy. And we can also verify that things are also okay with other experiments, and you've certainly seen that, and this is also a pretty good agreement. Now, what did we get from this? Well, of course, we get some refined values of cosmological parameters, but maybe in this audience, what was maybe the most important was the value of NS. And the thing that I wanted to draw your attention is we went from plus or minus 0.6 to plus or minus 0.006 in about 20 years. This is a 100-fold improvement. So this is sort of saying where the field has gone. Of course, I mean, there was some pretty strong incentive to go in that direction. And so I'll do a couple of those plots to sort of remind us of how much we've traveled the path and extracted information. Now, of course, you can do a bit more. You can do power spectral reconstruction, the primordial one, where because, of course, this is linear physics, so you essentially know how to infer the prime. And so this amounts to give you directly what is the power spectrum looking like once you marginalize about all of the effect of the cosmological parameters and the effect of during the linear phase. And that's, for instance, the Canadian rendition of this. So je pense que maintenant je dois moi aussi dire quelques mots en français. Ça ne me sera pas trop difficile étant donné que je suis français. Mais bon, je vais faire comme les orateurs qui ont été précédemment ici. I will switch back to English. Anyway, what you see on this is that without the prior now, you are not putting in that this should be a power law. I mean, you are just reconstructing it. And what you find is, well, here we're losing the signal just because, I mean, the signal is very weak and you are heard by noise. Here you are driven essentially by the low quadrupole that we know since the COBE days. And then you also confirm that there is this deficit at L about 20, which has attracted a lot of attention, but you can also see that when you marginalize essentially over the impact of parameters, this is about the 2 sigma level in the end. So yes, this might be telling us something, but this is a curse of having it at large scale, so we cannot extract much more information than this. So this is just suggestive. And of course, you can do many other ways. Here is another reconstruction where the knots are actually a variable number and they can be anywhere. And that's the same thing. If you just have the two, if you have zero additional knot, well, you find the power law, and this is 0.96. And then when you increase the number of knots, you sort of see how this L of 20 thing is appearing. But in the end, when you sort of weighed by the evidence all of this, I mean, you end up with the same answer, that this is something around 2 sigma. Now, this is still presuming that this is pretty much of a smooth spectrum. So you can go a bit further. You can throw at it the different specific models and looking for features. Now, you do, of course, I mean, you're adding degrees of freedom, so you find better fits. But then you can ask, well, is a delta chi-square sufficient? And you run simulations, and you find that actually this is not good enough. I mean, this is not warranted by the data. Of course, we search for things that came later on, like axion monodromy. There again, the chi-square improvement when you increase these degrees of freedom is not sufficient to claim that we've detected anything. One of the cool things with this is that you also have a specific prediction about the three-point function. So you can see if you do the three-point function, well, what are the which frequencies you seem to have a signal? And yes, there are some hints, but then the co-analysis doesn't improve in any way. And one of the masters of this is now a new postdoc at Perimeter, so, well, ask him some further questions. And now, in keeping with our glorious past, Niesel, here is additional constraints that on things which were initially quite possible, which are strings, well, or any defects, and, well, we found none, as you surely know. About the things of extensions which are interesting is looking for gravitational waves or actually tensor modes. And so you open the box of R non being set to zero initially, and these are the constraints. And what we found was R has to be smaller than about 0.1, sorry, at 95% confidence limit. And this is sort of the end of the story, because this is about the best you can ever do with temperature and isotropy. So this is indirect, and this is the end of the story. To go any further, you need direct analysis. Now, all of this was 2 point. Of course, I mean, there is potentially much more information. I mean, if it's not strictly a Gaussian field into the higher order moments. And here are just a reminder of a few typical shapes of what the bispectrum could be. Well, this is just the equivalent in harmonic space of the 3 point spatial function, and with various types that can be there. Now, here are the Planck results. And we measured about 2,000 of those modes. And in practice, when you are projecting this on these specific models, here are the constraints. And there again, I want to remind you, I mean, the constraints have gone from 10 to the 3 with maxima in 2001 to the upper limit, okay, at 95% confidence to 10. And there again, this is a 100-fold improvement in now in 14 years. Not bad. Things that haven't changed that much is the fact that there are some large-scale, low-significance things which are a bit bizarre, and you all know about this. Planck has just shown that this was not a business of systematic effects or foreground residuals or anything. This is in the sky. But the significance is still the same. Let me turn to something else, which is something that we didn't promise to do back in 96. We said we'll try whatever we can. So we did these beautiful maps, like at 30 gigahertz, 357 gigahertz, which is tracing dust polarization. And we extracted this particular map. And let me just blow it a little bit to sort of for you to appreciate. So in the background, these are the temperature and isotropies, right? And these are just the direction of polarization. And this is filtered at 20 minutes of arc. Now, what we already knew before the Planck results is there. So essentially 20 locations on the sky. And that's about it. Now, the image at 5 degree resolution from Planck is as following. And that's pretty much what was on my first slide. But actually, this is just because it's pretty hard to represent with high angular resolution. But this is actually at 1 degree angular resolution. And that's actually at 5 minutes of arc. So we've extracted quite a bit of information. But there is one thing that is missing, which is the very large scale modes. Those, we didn't publish them because we believe that we haven't tamed the instrumental systematics at the proper level to get them free in the community and get all kinds of signals for, you know, transplanckian physics or whatever. But you can still compute the power spectrum. And here is, for instance, a cross-correlation between the E modes and T modes. And here are just the measurement point in gray. And the blue are just bean average. And the red is a previous model. That is, this model is a lambda CDM model that is whose parameters have been set by analyzing temperature. So there is no degrees of freedom. This is a prediction with 0 degrees of freedom, and that works really well. Same for EE. And there is just one caveat there, which is we haven't exhaustively characterized things at that level of the green curve. So we did warn the community that this is not the final thing at the 1 microK² level. So if your science depends on these sort of wiggles at the 1 microK² level, this is not yet good enough. And the reason we found that was exactly when you do this same type of plots. Here is for TE. So same thing, you remove foregrounds, and then you look at differences between different detector sets or different arrangements. And immediately you see, oh man, this is a 4 sigma. Oh, here too. Let's see, oh man, this is a 5 sigma. So this 1 microK², when you just plot the power spectrum, and that looks completely tiny, but this is clear evidence that we are not done yet. And that's the reason why we warn the community that, well, be careful about this. Still, I mean, the broad brush model does not depend on this. I mean, at that level of detail, because it's essentially, you know, taken away by assuming lambda CDM. And if you do this, look at what you independently get on the parameters using TE. And essentially, apart from NS, you see that you find with comparatively similar error bars and exactly the same numbers. Well, that's pretty impressive, because this was by no means granted. And because in some sense we've measured, we are now having two probes on the universe, I mean, temperature and polarization, and we infer something about the state of the universe at, you know, well, 280,000 years or so. And the fact that they have such a remarkable consistency, I mean, it's just amazing. Of course, it also constrains any potential deviation from this basic model. And let me just remind you of one thing. In particular, one of the predictions of inflation was that they should be essentially mostly adiabatic fluctuations and non-Isar curvature. And this is really proven by the data. That is to say, when you look at polarization, you see this just exactly shift of phase. And so it's a direct indication, which is just the basis. Yes? Just let me finish this sentence. And then when you turn this into constraints on Isar curvature modes, you sort of see the reduction of the amount of allowed Isar curvature modes in the, which is essentially a factor of 10 improvement by throwing in polarization. Neil. I didn't say, I should have said adiabaticity. Okay, and that's, I think, I don't know whether what I wrote, no, adiabaticity, which is a natural outcome, but fine, you know what I'm talking about. Now, this is not all the information we can pull out with just about this two-point correlation function or constraints on the amplitude of bispectrum. We also know that gravitational lensing through the propagation, due to the propagation through large-scale structure of the image, gives us a distorted image. And this distorted image is essentially amounts to sort of say that you are looking, when you are looking in one direction, you are actually seeing something that was coming from a different direction. So there is a displacement field between the two, which you can actually easily compute. And to give you, for those that are not CMBers in the audience, some direct impression of what this does. Suppose this is a part of the field, this is a few degrees, and this is temperature, these are E modes, and suppose there are no primordial B modes whatsoever. When you turn on the propagation through large scale structure, that's what you get. And this is sort of remarkable, because what you see is that you see small displacements, they are by a few minutes of arc, but these are now coherent over very large scales, about degrees. So you've built up some correlations that you wouldn't expect to be there otherwise. And this, of course, applies to E modes. But, but now, if I take E, of course, for T, this is taken into account when you do the, you know, the parameter fitting. But for the E modes, this means that now your polarization field is not B mode free, and you just generate some lensing B modes, which is just what I showed here. And so these will be actually a source of signs, but also a nuisance in the sense that it can hide the primordial B modes if they are there. Now, using precisely the correlation between scales, well, you can build essentially what is the integrated gravitational potential that leads to this deflection field. And this is the minimum variance obtained by Planck this year, the combination of all estimators using temperature and polarization. And well, this is amazing, because this is telling us essentially the distribution of mass in all the observable universe, well, of course, projected. So we've sort of started to have an overall integrated distribution of all the mass. Well, of course, this is just like COBE. This is signal to noise of one at L of about 30. So these are the early days. You can proceed by computing the lensing power spectrum, and you see pretty much the state of the field between Planck and the others that actually preceded them in that direction. And now this is, for Planck, this is a 40 sigma detection. If you fix the shape, of course, of the amplitude. And this is actually starting to constrain which cosmology is allowed. You can even go further and compute what is the lensing B modes that you get. And so this one is not very useful, because it's a pretty low signal to noise. So in terms of, but I just well, we're just seeing the early days there, and what I want to see is high signal to noise for all these Lansing maps, and we have the capability of doing that. Now, we also know that among the same physics that is leading to the oscillations in the microwave background is also telling us that there should be the baryonic acoustic oscillations in the galaxy distribution. And within lambda CDM, Planck tells us that you expect that scale to be 147 megaparsec if, of course, W equals minus one, if there is nothing else. And so what you can do is play this game, that is to say, well, if you look at the acoustic scale distance ratio, which is there, and you compute it in the various surveys and express this in units of what you expect in the basic Planck model, lambda CDM model with Planck parameters, you find this remarkable consistency. And now we are really comparing a prediction based on measurement at z of 1,000 to something that is measured in our immediate vicinity. So we've understood something. With that, which is breaking some additional degeneracies, here are the kind of things you can do. And this one, I didn't think I would ever see this. So this is omega mirror versus omega lambda. And so they sum to one along this diagonal. Here is a fairly well-known degeneracy if you use temperature alone, well, CMB alone, in terms of where we could be. And you remember certainly some of the plots where we broke that degeneracies with supernovae and so on. But let's look here what it is. This is what you do temperature when you throw at it the polarization information. You are there. If you add the lensing that I just mentioned, well, which is starting to probe the Losey stuff, you are there, and if you add the baryons, you are there, and this is omega k equals 0 plus or minus 0.005. And again, let's look at how much path we've done. Well, omega k started to be measured in the 2000 when we got the first peak, and this is a measurement plus or minus 0.4, and this is the plot I was alluding to when you throw in the supernovae, and again, this is a 100-fold improvement in about 15 years. Now, I'm not going to go through everything. I mean, as you know, it is just the tip of the iceberg, just to remind us of how much path we've covered. But in short, we now have the temperature, the e-modes, the cross-correlation, the four-point, or the FIDE, which is the combination of temperature at different points, as well as BAO and things that I didn't mention, like Big Bang nucleosynthesis, supernovae measurements. All of those are all consistent among the SEBs and across experiment within the context of lambda CDM. And so this is passed with percent level precision, which is really quite remarkable. Of course, this means that we can open the Pandora's box and we can allow for many different checks. And well, you know, the constraints on neutrino masses, their sum has to be smaller than 0.23 eV and all of that stuff. Which is not to say that there are not tensions, and there are a number of them. I mean, one is with the Soniev-Zeldovich, but that's, I think, what this plot shows. This is CMB, and these are three different renditions using a different way of relating Y to essentially a mass proxy. And you see that depending on where you are either in quite a bit of tension to no tension at all. So it's not, I mean, so either we'll be learning about systematic effects, or we might be also learning about, you know, the physics of clusters. Make your bet. There are other tensions, and well, if anything, H naught and so on. So it's all of them have the potential to either reveal systematic effects in one or both type of experiments, or really ask for additional degrees of freedom in the model. Now, of course, you also know, since I was alluding about Niels' bet with Stephen, well, you all know that in 2014, we were all pretty excited by this extraordinary result. That is, there was the end of the upper limit game, and at 10 minus 2 microkelvin square, I remind you, in TT, the peak is at 6,000 micro K square. So, I mean, well, now we had a measurement, and well, some initial interpretation was that the search for primordial gravitational wave is over. And even more surprising, that R equal 0.2, And I would just remind you that the standard model was that Planck had put indirect upper limits of R of 0.1 and 95% confidence limit. So it was not only that this was over, but this was also showing that we had definite clues of what type of models we should extend it to. Well, one shouldn't underestimate the power of dust. And so, this is a 353 dust polarization map. And so after a couple of back and forth, in the end, we collaborated with the Bicep and Keck team to essentially try to estimate how much is their measurement is corrected when you actually include this extra knowledge. And what you see, it goes from the initial black dots to the blue dots, which are completely consistent with lensing. And so the only thing you can do is put an upper limit. And the upper limit that gets out of this is R smaller than 0.11 at 95% confidence limit, which is exactly the one that Planck already put by indirect means. Now, there has been a more recent measurement, which are throwing in some new data, which even tightens a little bit further. And so, well, a new era has begun. Now we can go much lower. Now, let me go back to this large-scale polarization stuff. Our maps in polarization are not, I mean, we used not the HFI maps, the higher sensitivity instrument, and for a very good reason, is when you look at spectra there and you do a number of null tests, you see, I mean, what we do by simulations, we expect, this is called FFP8, I mean, these are just forward simulations of what should be the noise level given the experiment, and you see that the null tests are actually very different. They are exceeding this by a factor of at least 10. So if you are looking at very large scales of the order of, you know, say 20, 30, there is no question, I mean, this is not only noise. So something has to be done. And in particular, if you are interested by looking at optical, at tau, which is this big bump here, big bump in units of, you know, 10 minus 2 microkelvin square. And part of the reason why we were I think you know why we were interested in, but for tau, let me remind you that this is due to the effect that the universe reionizes. So it has a damping effect due to this rescattering, but it also recreates at the very largest scale something proportional to tau square, which is this bump. And you can sort of see the amount that is expected for different value of the optical depth. The central value, the best fit of WMAP is not even on that scale. This is 0.09, okay? So this would be a whooping signal somewhere there. So in trying to address this, we have been going through a long period of processing improvement to try to get more general solution that we're at the map level. We'll try to account for a number of systematic effects that we knew we hadn't completely taken care of for the very largest scales. I mean, again, I mean this is very tiny at other scales. And so this new way of analyzing the data led to much improved maps at low multiples. And in particular, in this sort of pre-2016 rendition, we are now pretty close to being noise limited on all angular scales. Not 350, though. To give you some graphical evidence of how much improvement this represents, these were the results of the various null tests there. And here, how now in this pre 2016 release, how they look, essentially they are at the noise level. So now it starts to be meaningful to address questions about what is the value of tau. Now, it's still, you need to be able to co-use all of these frequencies to be able to do a calibration between various frequencies at really exacting levels. And here is essentially the relative calibration between all essentially the known frequencies from WMAP, from LFI, and from HFI, and look essentially what is the level. We are now typically at 0.1% accuracy of all this range. I mean, this is pretty amazing. And if you look in detail, even those that we'll be using in just the next few slides, this is at the level of 0.01% accuracy. So this is sort of setting a little bit the stage for future experiment. And I don't think I heard that the ground experiments were yet at that level of intercalibration. Of course, you have to worry about foregrounds. Well, the benefit of having low and high frequencies is we know how to address this and compute. In the end, this is what we get as of today. So here are the signal as predicted by the best fit of WMAP around here. Here are our data points, and here are other values like 0.07 and 0.05. You immediately see by eye that this is closer to 0.05. And so that's pretty much what we published. So the short history of tau is the following. This is starting from the 0.09 value. And then you see the reduction of uncertainties. And well, it's not too surprising. When you reduce the uncertainties, you tend to have the central value to go somewhat down. This is the limit from astrophysics. This is the lower limit. And when this is assuming a symmetrical form for the tau variation, this translates into a reionization redshift of the order of 8, and so the days of 16 are way past. That doesn't have huge implication for lambda CDM, apart from decreasing tension on sigma 8. But on the other end, for the constraints on reionization, when you compare with what is expected through the most current models on how the optical depth increases with redshift, as compared to our uncertainties, well, that's all fine. So it sort of removes the tension between the CMB and the models of reionization, which is based essentially on the formation of first stars and galaxy. So in brief, this is pretty much where we are. So when we started this game, there was this point known, and all of the rest was completely terra incognita. Nothing was there. I mean, even the first peak was not there. So you sort of see where we are. We've measured about 1.1 million modes measured with TT, about 100,000 with EE. We are in the tens range with BB. We are also in the tens range with the phi, which is high order. And then we have pretty weak constraints with TB and EB. And I've, as compared to this plot, I've added this sort of tau determination. So now we have a better view of where the points are there. So to me, it's pretty obvious that we have, I'm dreaming of you know, what we could do with a few million more modes. So let me first, at this stage of the talk, sort of remind that these results were obtained, I mean, by large collaboration with lots of individual, a lot of institute, and so on. And before moving on, I want to remind that this six-parameter based lambda CDM model is completely amazing. And if you had asked me back in the 90s, you know, the likelihood that we would get this, I mean, I would have said, well, this is very unlikely. Still, this is where we are. And we've gone that far with using our main two fundamental theories, GR and quantum mechanics. Plus some assumptions which are a little bit less, which are not completely trivial, like physics laws should be everywhere the same at all times, which is by no means trivial. And so I think it's pretty amazing that this works at that level. And I remind you, well, we've been talking about the constraints that we are putting here. These are trying to look at strength and curvature in this plot and looking at where the experimental constraints on GR are. And cosmology is probing this very weak corner. But the fact is, just using this theory and boldly using quantum mechanics with it, we've gone a long way in the sense that one can say that these bold hypotheses have had quite a bit of fruits in terms of predicting what we are measuring. Still, there are a lot of questions open. I mean, it's not in this audience that I have to remind you, but, and of course, I mean, Neil has been reminding us at every talk about, nearly every talk about this pressing question. We know that there might be completely different paradigm to explain the measurements. And also, I mean, you know, there are lots of questions about dark matter, dark energy, neutrinos, and so on. And what I want to say now, in the sort of 8 minutes left, is that CMB remains unique and powerful. So Planck has indeed, as promised, about exhausted the information content in temperature and isotropies. But as I tried to say earlier, there are still a lot of modes out there, and this is a unique source of still unknown cosmological information because it has a very pristine connection with early universe physics. You know, I come from large-scale structures, so I know what it means, baryonic physics, nonlinear physics, and so on. Going to CMB was going to sort of promised land. And indeed, and we haven't explored it, all of it. And so I think what we now want is to explore as much of the sky as possible with exacting but achievable sensitivities and control of systematics. And so, well, that's what we have to do. I'll say a few more words about this. By the way, I mean, when you do measurements with this kind of precision, you ensure that there is a lot of unsavory science that cope with it, in, if anything, on the interstellar medium or clusters. Now, one thing that hasn't been progressing since COBE days are essentially spectral distortions. I mean, we are still stuck, quote unquote, with this epoch-making experiment where, you know, you have to blow the error bars by 400 to be able to see anything. But we also know that we do expect to see some distortions as compared to this spectrum. And if anything, because we've counted the number of clusters of Soniev-Zeldovich effect, so we know that within a factor of 10 at most, we should be able to measure those. And as been mentioned by many people, yes, we are, might be opening two broad windows to probe at higher, at smaller, sorry, smaller scales, higher k's, the power spectrum, that is the conversion of these acoustic modes through silk damping, and this energy has to go somewhere, and that essentially depending on when this is released and so on, you will have deviations. And so it's a way to extend somewhat our reach on the primordial anisotropies. Of course, these are very broadband. So here you get at every k modes, you get a number. Here you get two numbers in all. But even more, there is also the fact that spectral distortions, I mean, they are not only coming from primordial origins. They're also, for the monopole, they are foregrounds. And foregrounds are likely to be fairly complicated too. So at a factor of 1,000, there is a lot of guaranteed science in terms of spectral anisotropies, which are non, maybe primordial, but that would be very interesting. Now, getting to really the more primordial range is actually very challenging. But anyway, I think we've got to go there. Now, returning to the point of the anisotropies, for the kind of things we could do, if you think in the, I'm revisiting the NSR plot, even for X inflation at 210 minus 3 for R, this is the kind of constraints we can envision having if we really mine the sky. And even if we don't find anything, as you all know, when around the 10 minus 3 range, this is precisely where you expect that if you you would exclude all high field class model. So this is essentially a no-lose situation or win-win. Well, not the same people, but clearly we have a very well-defined, target for the future. We want to be able to either find, well, X type inflation at 5 sigma, or essentially swamp, remove all the high field inflation. So that seems like an interesting goal. As soon as you do this, by the way, the lensing you would obtain, this is the sort of power spectrum of the lensing which I showed you earlier. Planck now is here. So it's signal to noise, minimum variance. I mean, that's the noise level. So it's about 1 at 1 scale. Now, if you think of the kind of satellite we could launch, this would turn into something like this, right? So you would have very high signal-to-noise measurement over all the scales, all the way to, say, a few hundred. And think of using this maybe with Euclid or whatever. So we'll do tomography of the dark matter distribution, and in particular, know what is happening at redshift of maybe 1.5 to 2, where there might be some interesting stuff there. Of course, for all of those, we'd still have to cope with this damn dust. It's still there. And so if you look at the sort of estimate now in polarization for dust, you see that this is not going to be easy because, I mean, you see that what you are trying to achieve even in relatively small fraction of the sky, 25%, say, at 100 gigahertz, I mean, this is still a good factor above what we're trying to go for. So this requires some kind of synergy of probes, because on the ground, you cannot go any further than, say, 250, 280 gigahertz. So it's very hard to actually have any handle on dust physics, which have proven to be its capacity of nuisance for CMB measurements. But the ground, of course, has a great advantage of allowing us to deploy big telescopes and doing very high angular resolution. On the other end, the space is likely, it can cover a very large frequency range, but you know, you cannot realistically deploy a 5-meter telescope, or you enter sort of GWST type kind of money, which I don't think is what we want. Now, there are many ways to look at the detail. This is a multidimensional space of the number of bands and so on. So I'm not going to bore you into the details, even though when you are trying to look seriously into this is what you have to cope with. But all of these different experiments promise some pretty spectacular reduction of the uncertainties on the number of parameters. Like, this is the RNT plot, or N run versus NS, or sum of M nu versus NF. All of those, in particular, have a look at what, for instance, CORE is a proposal that we're putting to the space agency right now. We just sent a letter of intent a few days ago. This is the kind of things that we'll be able to do. Now, it's not to say there won't be a lot of challenges. I mentioned, of course, sensitivity, foregrounds. Well, there is this big one, which are systematics. And there are lots of detail issues that will take us a lot of time to actually, you know, get through. And this is not the end of it. Yeah, I'm getting, but my talk is close to the end. Don't worry, Mr. Chairman. And so there are a lot of, and for this audience, this is probably proper, there are a lot of data analysis and processing challenges. If you think with this kind of accuracy, there are lots of issues like bandpass leakages, all kinds of low-level stuff that I don't want to bore you with, but which are really pretty hard to do. But let's be a little bit broader. Essentially, you are facing a data set which the analysis needs to be global, not of the particle physics type where you analyze each event separately. You need global solution. Well, that's bad. At this level, you have to be nonlinear. And the kind of things that you are interested, like lensing, well, this is non-Gaussian. Well, just this is our, these non-words are actually means that there are a lot of sweat ahead, but also a lot of opportunities. I mean, for theorists or data analysts, there are a lot of cool stuff to do with that. So that's what we'll have to do. Let me conclude. So I think, and I believe this pretty strongly, we should not be any more timid than when we dreamt of Planck. I mean, when we stand up at that time, we say, we want to do it all. I think we should have exactly the same attitude. This is an amazing mine of information, and so we want to do it all. And we know that what it requires. It's high sensitivity, all sky mapping, all high angular resolution, and large frequency coverage. Easy. Of course, you need to have the matching control of low-level systematics. And it's obvious that this can only be achieved through a combination of ground and space experiments. I mean, just because angular resolution, frequency coverage, spatial coverage, call for this complementarity. The final note is that given the timescale for CMB experiment in space, for any experiments in space, it's at the bare minimum like 15 years. So it's clear the future for the next 15 years will come all from the ground. And so we have to really do as far as we can. But in the end, we'll be limited. And so we have to decide now, because if we want to have the next stage in 15 years, the satellites have to be decided now. So if you're being asked whether this is interesting to do a next generation CMB satellite, well, get your acts together. So in my view, let's do it, and the sooner the better. Thank you.
Questions for François? John.
What is your opinion about the recently reported tension between local measurements of H naught and those for fluctuations, CMP fluctuations?
I alluded to it briefly. I mean, which is these are extremely difficult measurements. It's they are in particular difficult at the percent level. This measurement has a long and complicated history, should I say. So if we take at face value, there is a tension, and so one might start, poking at extensions, even though the most simple ones, I mean, it should be said that the simplest one, I mean, don't work very well. I mean, it's not, you cannot just crank up some number, because there you are immediately in tension with something else. So first of all, there hasn't been, on the theory side, that many sort of obvious candidate to resolve all of the tensions, and not only this particular one with H naught. You have to agree with the NF constraints and so on and so on. So now, I mean, when I was asked, I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, there, we have to know whether this is these are systematics or this is a first hint of a limit that we've reached the limit of the basic lambda CDM. Then the next question is, where do you think it's most likely to have residual systematic effects? Well, make your own pick. I've been trying to show you the level, well, at least a quick hint of the level of redundancy of cross-checks we've been going through, and so I have some confidence about the CMB results. So. But if the tension continues and we keep going and then it becomes a five sigma, well, yeah, we'll be forced into finding the proper theoretical explanation for it. So yes, let's also do this, improve and keep beating on this direct H naught measurement, as well as all of the others that can reveal a failure. It's true that for my own taste, if I had to pick up a domain where non-CMB where I would work on, I would probably not go in that direction. I think I would rather go towards 21 centimeter and so on to see whether we can tame the foregrounds and get all of these K modes where we could actually get to the type of FNL where we are guaranteed to have results. That would sort of be more exciting to me.
More questions?
But I'm just one individual.
One more question for François.
So, of course, this is amazing, and it's good that you put it in perspective how far we've come since these parameters were first measured. The question that one may have, to play devil's advocate, is what is the target? Like, how precisely do you want to measure things? Of course, you can keep doing things more and more precisely. So I wonder what your point of view is.
Well, I want to restate this pretty clearly. I think we do have a target, which is sigma r. Not r. R is a moving target. The accuracy on r. I think that the natural thing is a few times 10 minus 4. And the reasoning is very simple. If it's something like the minimal Higgs inflation that I can have, well, I want 5 sigma. I want to go to Stockholm, right? I mean, so no 1.5 sigma indication, I want 5 sigma. 5 sigma for something of 2 10 minus 3, well, it should be pretty close to 4 10 minus 4. And as I argued, if you don't find anything at this level, you've swept clean a full class of theory. So I think this is the obvious things we have to go for. This is what I want. Now, it's only one part of the story. I mean, at higher L, there is, of course, we want to be measuring the neutrino masses and be able to decide whichever way, whether this is inverted or normal hierarchy, what is the sum of the masses. I mean, this is a pretty obvious one, but that's a different spatial range. Then there is a question of the lensing part, okay, where it's a little bit more difficult. But I think it's essentially the lensing will come essentially out of the two previous goals. I mean, you know, we'll just have a fantastic dark matter, integrated dark matter distribution. So I'm pretty clear of what I would like to get is in terms of sigma r, and then drive all of the rest. And that's actually what I presented to ESA when I talked to the engineers and so on. I say, well, here is a rational. So we need to build a machine together where we have to control systematic effects at that level. And we don't want to be anything short of this.
Is it easy to justify 10 to the minus 4 as
a cost? Well, a few
cost.
Times 10 minus 4. I mean, 4 times 10 minus 4, I'd be happy.
How much does it cost?
Well, typically this is a Planck wrench, Planck similar to Planck. It's the same medium-sized type mission.
And what did ESA say?
That I don't know, because we'll be putting, I mean, the proposal, I mean, is due for September or October. I forgot the details. And then there will be all the committees and so on. And then people will ask their local theorists what they think and so on. And then maybe we'll get into a phase A study, and then at the end, you have this frenetic phase, which is called a phase A, where you not only have the goals, but you are getting into the details on how you accomplish the goals in practice. So this is, and then there is a day, which is the equivalent of 96 for Planck, where you have the community, and then you present the case, and you try to get to be the winner. That's.
I think we would all love to have 10 to the minus 4 on sigma R. So.
Well, you know what you have to do. The experimentalists also know what they have to do. I mean, there are a lot of things to worry about. And the one thing I want to insist on is the synergy between the ground and space. This is something that is not fully, often fully, not fully appreciated. Many developments, for instance, some data analysis and so on, have been really cross-fertilized between the two, having some fresh data on one end and having the long-term perspective of developing for a space experiment. We've made amazing strides. Now, think also, there is the same thing on technology. Ground deploys technology much faster, but space, I mean, cannot fail. So you spend a lot of money to actually develop some new technologies, engineer them, test them, and these are immediately used by the ground people. So we do have this constant talk on the technology and data analysis, which is going both ways all the time.
Okay, we have one more.
Neil wanted to say.
Then okay. Two more questions. I must not upset the director.
So you can comment a little bit more about the low L anomaly and what can happen in the future at the level of understanding.
Okay, well, first of all, I can mention that the curse of the low L anomaly is the fact that it's at low L, so we don't have that many modes, and so we have large error bars, and so we're bound even with perfect control of systematics of foregrounds and with low noise level, in the end, you are at the 2 sigma level. That's what I say for the L of 20. All of the others, when you look at look elsewhere effect and so on, they are between 2 and 3 sigma. We might be able to do slightly better from CMB when with the low L polarization that is coming. But that's going to be square root of 2, I mean, improvements. So it's not going to be like a crisp signal indication. The only way from the data side that we can improve is add more modes. I mean, and that has to do with, using 21 centimeter or whatever other probes, but that's not 21 centimeter in a small patch of the sky. Again, I mean, that you have to think really big. It's full sky, 21 centimeter. At the level of precision that I'm talking about. So we don't even know whether we can tame foreground. So it's a hope. It's not anywhere. If CMB looks challenging, well, think twice about 21 centimeter.
Okay, last question from.
Yeah, beautiful talk, and I totally agree with your point of view that this has to.
It's amazing.
Has to
once
happen.
In my life, I heard Neil and I agree on something.
But I think you're being underambitious because you need more than one satellite mission. It was very important at the LHC. They were very careful to have two independent experiments to verify each other. And I think the same is true of CMB, is that if we only have one satellite mission without any competition or checks or independent measurements, it's not enough. So I wanted to ask you, are you talking to Chinese at all?
I'm talking to a lot of people in Asia, everywhere. So let me say two things. First of all, Lei, I think that precisely part of the thing that the ground and space have to engineer is that there is sufficient overlap, that this cross-checking within the, you know, a good window, a good part of the sky, over a sufficient range of scales where we can actually cross-check the two. So I hate when people can say, oh, yes, I'll do it faster, cheaper, whatever, and then I don't need to be cross-check. Okay, so I think we need a substantial overlap. So that's one thing, and that will happen irrespective of the fact that there is one or two satellites. Now, there is something that I want to get back to, which are the spectral distortions. The spectral distortions, apart from small niche of little band at very low frequency, the only way to do this is from space. It so happens there is a proposal called PIXI. PIXI is doing two type of things. It's doing the monopole part, so that has to be done from space. There is just no other way. But by its very principle of being a polarized interferometer, if you wish, it also offers a different way to look at, well, essentially B-modes and at very low angular resolution. So this one would be, so it has a number of distinct advantages in terms of very large frequency coverage, the potential advantage of being a different type of measurement. The counter arguments for this is that we've never used this type to do this type of experimental setup to do these kind of measurements, and the CMB is full of apparently brilliant ideas, and when you do them, well, it just doesn't work because these are difficult measurements. So we don't know whether this will deliver on its promises, so I wouldn't certainly put this as my flagship. I would try, but I wouldn't put all my eggs into this. I mean, that's one. Second, by definition, it's a very low res. 2.6 degrees top hat, okay? So it means that you have a very small number of pixels on the sky, maybe 6,000 out of the galactic plane. Every pixel has a very complicated mixture of all kinds of foregrounds. So if I had to make the decision, I would select PIXI as a pathfinder on one end, and in particular to know how far you can go for spectral distortions, and I showed you the plot where, you know, we have to tame a lot before we can go to the fundamental levels. But to me, it's interesting enough. And I would do CORE, and I would not do LightBird. I mean, to be even more specific, I mean, I want the angular resolution. I want the overlap with the ground. So yes, I would go for two satellites, but a very different types and cost. I mean, they're because they have each their very specific advantages.
Okay, let's end there. Thanks again, François.